Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Today on our show, why the San Joaquin Valley is home to so many vaccine deserts. And later, is there a legislative fix for communities lacking clean water? But first, a small foothills community in Fresno County is at the center of a proposed name change. Organizers say the word squaw in Squaw Valley is a demeaning racial and sexual slur for Indigenous women. But as FM89's Sarith Hawk reports, there's a debate about where the fight to change the name is originating.
Gladys Dick McKinney has just made a quick stop for strawberry jello at the Dollar General on Highway 180. She's making a cake for her brother's birthday, but before she heads out, she takes a minute to talk to me about the proposed name change and even asks me to sit in her air-conditioned car.
Go ahead, the door's open.
She says she's lived here all of her life and doesn't mind the name.
As far as Squaw Valley offending me, that name does not offend me, and I'm an Indian woman, a mother.
Dick McKinney is part of the Dunlap Band of Mono Indians. She says she first heard of the effort when it was scheduled for discussion at an Orange Cove City Council meeting in January this year.
We're not even in the district. That's a city. We're county.
The discussion was postponed, but not before it caused an uproar on social media because it surprised so many locals. Dick McKinney says she understands that the term may hold different meanings in other tribal regions.
What does that have to do with us? That's a language in that area.
Here, she says it just means women, even if it came from outside settlers.
When they came into the valley and they seen these large encampments of women working, and most of them were women because men had different duties and women had different duties, somebody tagged it Squaw Valley.
Dick McKinney suggests I talk to another lifelong resident, Lenora Cannon.
But I could take you over there where she lives.
Yeah.
You follow me. And
okay.
We head east and a few minutes later arrive at a ranch house off of 180. Cannon comes out to the door.
Gladys, how old is Rusty?
He'll be 74 tomorrow.
74.
Rusty is Dick McKinnon's brother. Cannon, who is white, tells me everyone knows her as Muggs.
My grandfather used to put me on the horse, they said, in front of him and say, what a cute little Muggins. And that name stuck.
Muggs is 92, and she's a fixture here. She was a teacher for years, and she still takes care of the local cemetery her family donated decades ago. She knows everyone, including the Native Americans who live here.
All the others, the Dicks, the Charlies, the Osborns, I know all of those families because we've been close.
She says she called up her Native American friends when she first heard of the name change to see how they felt about it, and most wanted to keep it.
So why would somebody come up with that now when me, I'm 92 now, I never thought of something like that. It was always a thing of beauty to me.
But Muggs realizes the name change is not up to her. According to the 2010 census, about 3,000 people live here. 85% are white, less than 3% are Native American.
I would have to know how my Indian friends actually felt, because I believe they're the ones that they would be the ones that would be hurting. And I agree with anything that they want.
But Roman Raintree disagrees that locals don't want a name change. He says the tribes in the area are still applying for federal recognition, so they're afraid to speak out.
I'd like to bring our first
Speaker.
A couple weeks ago, he held a virtual presentation to discuss the history behind the word squaw. He refers to the area only as S Valley. Raintree identifies with the Dunlap Band of Mono Indians and the Choinumni tribe.
We propose Noom Valley. It's not a name that we are dug our heels in. In fact, a lot of residents have suggested Bear Mountain Valley.
He's working on an application to change the name with the U.S. Board on Geographic Names. And an online petition he started on change.org has more than 16,000 signatures to date. Raintree says the name is sexually derogatory to Native American women and girls, and that using it enables a history of violence against Indigenous women that is still present today.
This name lends itself to complicity, not thinking that it is a derogatory term that is not pejorative, that rather it is a term of honor, when in fact it is not.
Fresno County Supervisor Nathan Magsig oversees the unincorporated area as part of his district.
With this effort, I have no problem changing any name of any community, but it needs to be a process that's driven by the local people.
Magsig says he's yet to see consolidated local support for the name change or efforts to hold a town hall meeting that all residents can attend. 69-year-old Lonnie Work sits in a squeaky office chair at his business, Squaw Valley Realty. It's a small, standalone building painted yellow with the sign above the door. Work's family has been here for 8 generations, originally as cattle ranchers. He's white, but he's married to a Native American.
I'm married to an Indian. She does not find anything wrong with the term.
He remains skeptical that the people who live and work in Squaw Valley are pushing for the change, but if that's the case, he says he would be open to it.
Well, hopefully, that would be left to the people that actually live here, not a bunch of people that come in as either short-termers or pretending to speak with the voice of the people that are here.
Raintree won't say where he lives because he fears retaliation from those who don't want a name change. But he says he has a strong connection to the community.
My grandparents lived there, so every summer I would go up and I would stay with my grandparents. And that's how I forged that deep connection. My mother grew up there. So I've been up there since I was a little guy.
Raintree says he is planning another online meeting to propose a new name. The date is set for August 11th. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Sarith Hawk.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. San Joaquin Valley residents could receive a monthly child tax credit of up to $300 starting July 15th. FM 89's Madi Bolaños reports it will be available to families who make up to $150,000 a year.
During a press conference Thursday, Fabiola Gonzalez with First 5 Fresno County said many residents were struggling to pay rent long before the pandemic, and that continued this past year.
Parents couldn't focus on how do I make sure that my child is thriving at home if I'm worried about enough money for rent, enough money for electricity.
The new child tax credit, she said, will help families pay for basic needs like rent and child care. Congressman Jim Costa, who represents parts of Fresno and Madera counties, said this tax credit will benefit 95% of the children in his district.
This provides a lifeline to middle class, lower middle class, and in my district, lifts 27,000 children out of poverty.
The tax credit is set to expire at the end of the year, but Costa and local advocates are pushing to make it permanent. Qualified residents who submitted their 2020 tax returns can expect an automatic payment. Residents who did not should go to irs.gov and click the Child Tax tab to sign up. Residents with I-10 numbers also qualify. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Mari Bolaños.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Vaccine rollout is proving far more challenging in rural communities, creating what are called vaccine deserts. And according to the Documenting COVID-19 Project, a national effort to make pandemic-related data more transparent, vaccine deserts are springing up across the San Joaquin Valley, causing concern among public health professionals. I spoke with the project's lead, Derek Kravitz, who works at Columbia University's Brown Institute for Media Innovation. Also joining the conversation was Caitlin Antonios, a reporter and researcher for the project, and Laura Salcido, an administrative specialist with Tulare County Public Health. Derek, I'll start with you. How did the Documenting COVID-19 project come about?
Sure. So we wanted to go ahead and provide and help newsrooms and the public and academics understand the virus and its spread and the policies being instituted at the local level to deal with the virus in the early days, March 2020. It's a grant-funded initiative housed at Columbia University to get public records, documents, data from local health departments, governor's offices, other government bodies, and then share them with newsrooms and the public and write stories. Caitlin has been based in California and been actively looking at the vaccine rollout in California, specifically the Central Valley. Caitlin has done quite a bit of work covering vaccine rollout for CalMatters as part of a USC Health grant and fellowship. Specifically the stories that dealt with Tulare County dealt with a government contractor named OptumServe that has had some successes in testing and some not so great successes in getting vaccine things into shots in the arms. She's also working on vaccine rollout, vaccine desert stories across Fresno and Tulare counties with NPR affiliates.
Well, Caitlin, let's bring you into the conversation. What have you found so far?
I found a lot. Obviously, California is a very large state. It's a very diverse state. And I think both public health officials and the California Public Health Department, as well as Governor Newsom, were very aware that there were going to be challenges, that it was going to be a lot of moving parts to get this vaccine rollout quickly and efficiently. And there was a lot of conversation about vaccine equity and making sure that the people who needed the vaccine the most were the people that were getting it. And so through the course of my reporting and my research, I found that there have been some roadblocks and at times some trial and error, but given how intense and how rapid this vaccine rollout happened, everyone was really just trying to do their best. And the stories that I've worked on have primarily been related to farm workers getting their vaccines, community care clinics who were not initially prioritized for vaccine distribution, but eventually were some of the groups that did end up getting the vaccine and making sure that people who have access to community care clinics could get the vaccine there. And mainly what we've seen is that because it's such a diverse state and there's so many moving parts, it's been difficult to make sure that everyone who needs the vaccine is able to get it quickly.
Well, Laura Salcido with the Tulare County Public Health Department, you've been on the front lines of this work. Can you talk about some of the obstacles or some of the hurdles that you have encountered in rolling out the vaccine in Tulare County?
Yes, thank you for the question. So yes, addressing vaccine availability here in Tulare County has been a challenge. Not an obstacle necessarily, because we're working very much on addressing the health equity portion of making the vaccines available to all our residents. However, I would like to focus a little bit more on some of the factors that have been seen throughout the rollout of the vaccines here in the county. So to start off, I would like to focus more on the accessibility. So how accessible initially were the vaccines since the rollout had begun? So with that in mind, we had to actually consider if the appropriate tools were in place for the residents to register for the vaccines, right? Did they have internet access? Did they have transportation? Was it available to them? Did they have the time to take from work or from their daily lives to access these vaccines? In addition to that, just considering their language, you know, was there a language barrier and so forth? With that, we would like to focus more on the affordability aspect of the vaccine. So, you know, initially the vaccine is free. I mean, all residents can access the vaccine through multiple channels here into their county and throughout the state. Lastly, on accessibility. So how are Tulare County and the residents, you know, in general, accepting the vaccine messages and the vaccine availability and accessibility throughout the county? With that in mind, we have to, again, focus language and cultural barriers and be more sensitive as to what messages we are actually communicating with our public and our community. But overall, I feel confident that we are advancing in the vaccine availability to our residents throughout the state. So I think overall, we will have we're working hard.
So for folks who are listening in Tulare County who still need to be vaccinated, where should they go?
So I would like to invite our listeners and community members to access the myturn.ca.gov website or call the number 833-422-4255. In addition to this, also those needing assistance for registration purposes, please call the 559-685-2260 number, which is also the Tulare County 211. Lastly, you can access the covid19.tularecounty.ca.gov online website, where you are able to access the vaccination locations within Tulare County. We do have two additional vaccine events taking place this weekend, beginning Friday evening. For Friday evening, July 19th, the vaccine event will be taking place in 14656 Road 192 in the city of Poplar, California, between the hours of 3 p.m. and 8 p.m., which will be allowing the 12-year-old and older population to be vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine. Now, for Saturday event, July 10th, we will be having a vaccine event at the Mooney Grove Park in the city of Visalia. This will be taking place between the hours of 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. In addition, also vaccinating 12-year-olds with the Pfizer vaccine.
You know, one term that has emerged in the process of this vaccine rollout is vaccine desert. Derek, how has the Documenting COVID-19 project come to define that term?
So, you know, typically an area, a census tract, a zip code, in some cases a county or a state that is falling below what is considered the average rate or the median rate of vaccination, first dose administered or full vaccination. And, you know, typically what we see with vaccine deserts is exactly what Tulare has seen with respect to language barrier, lack of access to transportation, living in unincorporated or rural areas, and maybe not seeing a pop-up or mobile clinic near them, and thus, you know, not knowing what's available as far as a vaccine clinic. Also, you know, people just being busy, having a long work day, and maybe the time of a vaccine clinic doesn't jive with their work schedule. So all those factors, and then of course hesitancy, and that cuts across race, age, partisan, political leanings, etc. So, you know, a lot of different factors coming into play lead to vaccine deserts. And even though California is doing well, you know, as a state when it comes to vaccination rate, there are pockets of vaccine deserts in the Central Valley that
with the spread of, say, the Delta variant, Delta Plus, or you know, future variants, could be vulnerable to spread.
Yeah, Caitlin, maybe you could say more about what you have witnessed in terms of looking at California. You know, Derek mentioned the Central Valley as being a region in which we see these vaccine deserts emerge. Are there other parts of the state that are having similar struggles in getting the vaccine into people's arms?
Yeah, I think there are, you know, every county, even if the county, for example, has like 70% of vaccination rates, there are zip code or census tract areas where that number is significantly lower. And so it isn't just focused in the Central Valley, but because of how large geographically the Central Valley is, and like Derek mentioned, there are unincorporated and very rural areas, that's where we've seen, you know, areas, cities, or regions where this uptake in those areas has been particularly low.
So, Laura, can you kind of bring us up to speed as to where the vaccine rollout stands in Tulare County?
Yes, of course. So as of Tuesday, July 6th, 32.6% of Tulare County population have been fully vaccinated. So in other words, there is about 158,000 Tulare County residents that have completed their vaccine series. So over the course of 2 weeks or so, we have seen an increase, especially because we have been engaging more on community outreach and addressing vaccine hesitancy throughout Tulare County. So we are very hopeful that we will continue seeing more vaccination appointments in the future.
Can you say more about those outreach efforts? What exactly are you doing and how are you getting through to folks?
Oh, goodness. Okay. Well, we are doing a lot. So to start off, I would like to share that we are, well, in Tulare County and public health, we have a health equity, quote unquote, team that is basically guiding promotoras, also known as community healthcare workers, in the outreach journey throughout Tulare County. So how that looks like is basically identifying rural or unincorporated communities within the county and having these community health workers, also known as promotoras, reach out to them either to provide education on vaccine registration, testing efforts as well. And that is actually an effort that is, you know, has been conducted every day, every week. You know, we're always addressing the community's needs, and more so we're actually meeting them within their communities, you know, so we're not having them necessarily come and meet us at either a vaccine event or so forth, but we are reaching out to our communities. We are going out to the communities and establishing these relationships, you know, building on the trust, and more so addressing that vaccine hesitancy that has been seen throughout the state, not just Tulare County. In addition to that strategy, we have expanded vaccine accessibility through mobile units. Also with the doctor offices, we have doctor offices that are registered to provide vaccines. We have pharmacies such as CVS, Walgreens, just to name a few private pharmacies that are also delivering vaccine availability throughout the county. In addition to that, we do have ambulance providers, American and Imperial Ambulance, which are conducting community vaccine accessibility by meeting the needs of individuals that are either bed or home bounded. So there is a contact and the individual cannot leave their home. So the ambulance actually drives over to their home, to their location, and vaccinates the individual. So that is actually being expanded down more to the southern locations in the county. So trying to focus more on neighborhoods or communities within Tipton, Pixley, Tarabella, Ducor, Ellensworth, which tend to be a little bit more of a smaller community and could potentially be exposed or identified as a vaccine desert area and whatnot. So with all of that in mind, we do have other entities supporting Tulare County with vaccination efforts. So we have Carter and Curative,
And of course, with the support of community-based organizations, with community partners, with clinics, with hospitals, they are all providing their planting their seed in expanding the vaccine accessibility within to their county.
Well, I'd like to come back and talk some more about the Documenting COVID-19 project. You know, one of the things that we quickly realized in covering the pandemic was how critical access to accurate, timely data was coming from county health departments, and also accessing public documents. All of that became just really vital tools that we as journalists needed in order to keep the public informed. And to that end, Derek, I would love for you to talk a little bit more about why this was such an important project or what you hope to accomplish with this work.
You know, local health departments have been putting in tireless hours, for a year plus in coordinating these efforts, like you've heard. And a lot of the day-to-day work they're doing, doesn't get publicized, doesn't get recognized, isn't fully appreciated. And in a lot of cases, there is a wealth of data, say in California with the CARE data or CalVax or various other data collected on vaccinations, where each county will cut the data and create a pivot table or a spreadsheet and drill down into what zip codes or race or ethnicities or age groups are not getting what they need. That's really important work. And we felt like in certain areas, newsrooms and the public didn't have access to that for various reasons. There's a lot of newsrooms that are closing up shop, that are furloughing their staffers, that don't have the resources to pay FOIA fees, to expend the time and effort to even talk to a county health department about what they're seeing on the ground. And so that's why we thought, we would target, places across Chicago, New York City, across the state of Michigan, recently with Missouri, all across the state of California, just to name a few. And, with respect to Tulare, we were struck by the amount of data collected by the agency, the amount of time and patience and care that went into reaching some of these communities. And then, also the struggles, the bureaucratic struggles that any health department has with the state, with community-based organizations, with, other groups, because this is, again, an unprecedented, massive effort. And there's going to be obstacles. And to help explain that in a thoughtful way with data, documents, and reporting is sort of the gold standard. And that's why we thought, at the very least, we would target places that we felt needed the help.
And Caitlin, maybe you could peel back the curtain for us a little bit and tell us about the work that you're doing and how you're doing it, where this information is coming from, and how you're accessing it.
A lot of the work that I do is based on sending in a public records request to the county health department. Sometimes there is a designated PIO or a records officer who is in charge of that request. Sometimes it's taken care of in smaller departments by one of the health department staff members who answer these requests. And I do my best to work with them to make the requests easier for them, not as time consuming, of course, to cut down costs, and try to peel back the curtain on what is going on in these health departments and what efforts are working and being really successful and what efforts maybe need some rethinking or adjusting based on discussions that are being had. And, California's Public Records Act is a very useful tool, and public records in general provide a really good look at what is going on in real time with decision makers and, people who have been elected to sort of represent constituents and or make policy that affects daily life. And so I have sent in a request for every single county in the state of California, all 58, and had, varying results of success. Like Derek mentioned, Tulare has been a place that has been very responsive, and I think it's beneficial to both us as reporters, but also to the health department. And, I've had a lot of conversations with people in health departments who have benefited from the reporting that we've done as well and what we're seeing on the ground and the people we've been talking to. So it is a mutually beneficial relationship to be able to be transparent about this data and really take a look, because ultimately the goal is to come out of the other side of this pandemic as quickly and safely as possible.
Well, it will certainly be interesting to see how this sort of database of information is utilized to help us all wrap our heads around what we have just lived through and hopefully learn some lessons from it on the other end. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. I've been talking with Caitlin Antonios and Derek Kravitz, both of them from the Documenting COVID-19 Project, along with Laura Salcido from the Tulare County Public Health Department. Thank you all for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. The January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol took place 6 months ago this week. Our colleague at Cap Radio, PolitiFact California reporter Chris Nichols, breaks down the extent to which false claims influenced those who took part in the riot. He spoke with Cap Radio anchor Randall White for the station's ongoing segment, Can You Handle the Truth?
Chris, tell us what our colleagues at PolitiFact in Washington, D.C. investigated.
Hey, Randall. PolitiFact reviewed court filings for more than 400 defendants arrested on charges tied to the riot. And these defendants range from current and former law enforcement officials to a Washington, D.C. music teacher to conspiracy theorists here in California. And PolitiFact found many of them saw their actions as patriotic, but they also found that many of them were driven by the lie that the election was stolen and motivated by other misinformation.
Now, let's stay on the falsehood about the election being stolen. Remind us how that lie was really weaponized ahead of January 6th.
It really was exploited, Randall. This lie was promoted for months by former President Donald Trump. It was also repeated over and over again on conservative cable TV channels such as Fox News, Newsmax, and One America News Network, as well as on social media.
And the false narrative about widespread voter fraud and a stolen election was repeated even as election officials certified the results, correct?
That is correct. Some of these cable channels and Trump himself continued to spread these false claims even as local, state, and federal officials verified that this was a free and fair election. Several recounts were held, but they only reinforced President Joe Biden's victory in key swing states. And importantly, judges in courtrooms across the country, some of them appointed by Trump, rejected more than 50 lawsuits brought by the former president or his allies alleging election fraud.
In its investigation, PolitiFact found many of the defendants charged in the January 6th insurrection were influenced by other strains of misinformation. Tell us about that.
In about half of the 430 cases PolitiFact looked at, the court document showed how false narratives really shaped the lives of these individuals. There was a music teacher in D.C. who amplified conspiracy theories on his podcast and YouTube channel, including the baseless conspiracy that the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting never happened, that former NBA star Kobe Bryant is still alive, even that the earth is flat. There was also a 54-year-old woman from Pennsylvania who suggested on Facebook that Democrats have, quote, been trafficking children for years, end quote. A witness testified that she had lost customers at the restaurant where she worked over her views on politics.
PolitiFact spoke with some experts in the spread of disinformation. What did they say about how this false narrative about a stolen election can be stopped?
Well, they say that many of these defendants truly believe this false information and will continue to spread it. The experts say it's really up to the people in power, some who are also spreading these lies but don't necessarily believe them, to shut this down. Experts say those people need to reject these false narratives.
That was Cap Radio's Can You Handle the Truth? You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. When the one working well serving the unincorporated community of Teveston in Tulare County stopped working last month, the roughly 1,000 people who live there were left without running water in the middle of a drought. As the community waits for bureaucracy to clear the way for the well to be repaired, State Senator Melissa Hurtado has been pushing for a legislative fix to the Valley's water infrastructure. I spoke with her about the status of the bill she authored and what's next for the people who call Teveston home. I'd like to start with your food and water resiliency tour. Where has that taken you and what have you learned along the way?
The state water and food resiliency tour is about really trying to educate Californians about the connection between water and food. And I've gone to dairy farms in Tulare County to learn about dairy and to also share with the community what we do in the Central Valley, but really how water is important to that particular region for the entire nation.
So something that, of course, we've been following closely is the situation in Teveston. Where do things stand currently for those residents?
So they need to have their well either fixed and or replaced. That has been a matter of the dealing with bureaucracy at the moment and making sure that they can get the necessary funds to get the wells, to get the well fixed and or replaced. At the moment, there is no end in sight as to when they will be able to receive the necessary funds or replacement of that well. And in the meantime, they're getting water delivered from the city of Porterville, which is, it's a 25-mile drive away from that small community.
Well, I'd like to talk about some legislation that you have introduced, specifically Senate Bill 559, the State Water Resiliency Act of 2021. Well, tell us a little bit about the bill and what you hope it will accomplish.
So I first introduced SB 559 back in 2019, my first year in the California State Senate. I knew back then, even as a freshman member, that water was important, not just to the Central Valley, but for the entire state. And sometimes at least the feeling in the Central Valley is, and I share this feeling that we kind of are either left behind or there's really a lack of understanding of how important the Central Valley is to the state of California. So when I introduced the bill, I focused in on the Fryant-Kern Canal. The canal itself in the Tulare County area has sunk, and it's the water that it's carrying to communities and to farms has lost its capacity by 60%. That means that we're not managing our water the best way that we can, and we're not being efficient with the water that we have. And it's a very precious natural resource that we have that we need to better protect. But on top of that, the communities are really losing out on that additional water that is just desperately needed. So I authored SB 559 to seek funds to repair that canal.
As you mentioned, this is the second time that you've introduced the bill. The last time around, it had wide bipartisan support, but was ultimately vetoed by Governor Newsom on the grounds that it wasn't holistic enough. What do you think the outcome will be this time around if the bill reaches his desk?
I really don't know. I don't have an answer on that. My hope is to educate as many Californians and really Americans about what is going on here in the Central Valley, how these projects that we have in the new version of SB 559 that we introduced this year, and just the role that it plays, not just for Californians, but for all Americans, because water delivered to the Central Valley means food, it means jobs, it means health. And when you take or you don't invest in the water infrastructure for Californians, really you're impacting all Americans. And as you can see in the small community of Teveston, that is a mostly a farm worker community that is now out of their water infrastructure in the wells. And also the fact that the Fryant-Kern Canal provides water to the basin that they sit on top of. So when you don't fix the broken system that you have, then you have the water shortages that we have today. And if we don't take immediate action, the consequences and the impact are going to be much more significant. We're talking about significant job loss, not just for farm workers, although they will be hurt the most, but we're also talking about, you know, food being, exported. And also, I think that it would potentially create a food crisis, a global one. So the consequences and lack of investment are going to be significant. They're not just going to be specific to the Central Valley.
And can you just detail what changes you've made to the bill?
So the version this year adds additional projects that also need to be fixed, including the California Aqueduct, the Delta Mendota Canal, the San Luis Canal, and the Frank Kern Canal.
How would SB 559 interact with some other pending legislation that's also in the works?
So we have U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein and Congressman Jim Costa, who have a companion bill at the federal level to invest in water infrastructure projects like the ones that are mentioned here in SB 59. They're pretty much companion bills to invest the necessary funds on these broken water conveyance systems.
You know, what we've been talking about is not a new problem. Water has been historically an issue in the Central Valley, and communities throughout the region have some of the smaller rural areas have struggled to access safe drinking water for years. So what in your mind would it take to provide a true long-term solution?
I think we need to bring experts in along the way. I think the most urgent need is to repair what we have, but we really need to be looking towards the future and figuring out where our fresh water is going to be coming from in terms of the climate change that we're experiencing now and how it's going to change over time and where that supply is going to come so we can adequately invest in our water infrastructure for the future. But the most urgent and present need is investing in the infrastructure that we have today. And water infrastructure is something that has been part of the history of California dating back to, as early as 1960s when President Kennedy arrived for the groundbreaking ceremonies of the San Luis Dam. And it will be, almost 60 years next month that he was here in Los Banos for the groundbreaking. And it just goes to show that we need to reinvest, and there has always been a need, and we need to continue to invest on this water infrastructure that provides clean water for communities and individuals, and of course for our farm communities as well.
Well, I've been talking with California State Senator Melissa Hurtado. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Kathleen Schock. Last year, the Creek Fire and other blazes around California sent so much smoke into the San Joaquin Valley that, at times, the air was brown and ashes rained down like snowflakes. We know long-term air pollution is bad for our health, but what about these short-term bursts from wildfires? To learn more, FM89's Carrie Klein sat down with Kevin Hamilton, executive director of the Central California Asthma Collaborative. He began the conversation with just how noxious last year's fire season was.
It was a rolling disaster. It just seemed like fire after fire dropping tons of really toxic particulate matter on residents here in the valley. I think our air pollution index was in the unhealthy range for probably 2/3 of the 7-8 months we had wildfires going on.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned this toxic particulate matter. Is that the most harmful, component of wildfire smoke? What makes wildfire smoke harmful?
So it's mostly the black carbon. So you've got black and brown carbon, different types of carbon. Carbon acts in a couple of different ways. It binds at that level because it's so tiny, it can be molecular. So it can bind with other things to create toxic materials out of things that weren't originally toxic. Ammonium nitrate is a good example, which is something that we see in the valley here, usually in the late fall, early winter. But now we've suddenly got it happening other times of year. It also causes irritation to the lung tissue down there, which opens the lung up to outside infection. And in a period of time when we've got viruses like COVID running around, which again are respiratory viruses, makes those people more vulnerable to those diseases. And over time, that damage can create diseases like emphysema. Now, you would have to be exposed regularly year after year. Does this sound familiar to you? And so that's what we seem to be seeing since what, 2012, 2013? Worst fires ever, and the fire period, the wildfire period, seems to be extending.
Well, so the health impacts of these particles, of this particulate matter, you know, they're relatively well documented, as you said, especially in the long term, you know, associated with long-term exposure. But so, you know, we may have wildfires year after year after year, but they presumably only happen for a short period of time. So are these short bursts of wildfire smoke, are they still harmful in the long run?
I think the short period myth is slowly breaking because they're successive. And so, and the Creek Fire, for example, went on for a month and change. So the, you know, the periodicity of the fire, I think, is changing as well. Back in the day, yeah, wildfires came, gone, 2-3 weeks, see you later. Next one comes a month later or something. But now they're just rolling right over top of each other. One ends, the other begins. So, you know, the short-term health effects is, of course, for people with irritable airway diseases like asthma, it's going to trigger that. For people who have high blood pressure, it's going to drive their blood pressure up. For people who are vulnerable to high blood pressure, they're also vulnerable to stroke. So you may see higher rates of stroke. You know, the health implications are wide. We know that black carbon affects development of the fetus, so there's a problem there as well. That's been really well documented by our local Children's Health and Air Pollution Study Group from Berkeley and Stanford and UCSF. And UC Davis has documented similar outcomes. So other than that, just the irritation of the eyes, nose, and the skin itself, it shouldn't be discounted as a constant irritant that opens people up again to other disease conditions or makes their chronic disease worse. It's a bad actor.
And so far, we've mostly been talking about these tiny particles, PM2.5, but then, of course, there are larger particles, PM10. There's ash, which you can visibly see. Are these harmful as well?
All the same. You inhale ash, you're inhaling not just the ash, which will mostly be stopped in your mouth and nose, but there's always particles that are going to escape. And again, it's going to trigger coughing fits. It's going to cause what looks like allergic rhinitis, but of course isn't. It's just a runny nose and red eyes from being exposed to this. It also gets in your ears and can cause a problem there.
And so where can we go during wildfire season or even during the rest of the year? You know, where should people go to get real-time information about the air quality in their area?
There's two places to go, really three. So I would say primary would be the Air District's website and sign up for the real-time air advisory network. The other place to go is the network that, with our partners here in the San Joaquin Valley, we've developed called sjvair.org, where we have only PM2.5 monitors, and data is being calibrated regularly using the standard EPA-approved algorithms. And it also contains all the Air District's CARBs and EPA's regulatory monitors. And as of the end of this month, people will be able to sign up for a text notification when PM2.5 rises. And you can actually trace the smoke as it's moving down across this really robust group of monitors that's far more dense than the regulatory monitoring system. And then EPA would be the third, not suggesting any bias, but the new administration has reopened the EPA for business in our world, at least. The web pages are working again, and we're able to access some of the really wonderful and accurate information on wildfire that the EPA has always had and continues to create. So those are the three places I would go.
Fair enough. And for the EPA, their tool is specifically called Air Now, correct?
Thank you.
Yes, it's an app and a website.
I should say that, yes.
Mm-hmm. And
it's very cool.
Yes, indeed. And have a neat map and everything, a color-coded map.
Better graphics than anybody, yeah.
So there have been a few episodes of bad air already this year, but the worst of fire season is obviously still ahead of us. So is there anything that we can do now to prepare for if and when the smoke settles over the valley?
One thing that's really critical is secure your home environment. So if you haven't done it, take a look at the seals on your doors. If you can afford it, I hope you have double pane or triple pane windows, but at least make sure they close tightly. This is not the time to open the windows and doors, even in the morning or at night when these wildfires are going on, for those who are able to tolerate that. We have a huge number of people in the valley who still are living with things like swamp coolers and with broken air conditioning units or no air conditioning. For those folks, this is a very difficult time. Masks, the only mask that's been proven completely effective is the N95, which is very difficult to wear in a working environment, though there are some great projects with farm workers that our colleagues, CCEJN, Central California Environmental Justice Network, are running. But the problem that you have is not just the wildfire, but the incredible heat that we experience here in the valley. So I'm hoping that cities will open up cooling centers and start thinking about wildfire smoke. Well, maybe it's not 105 degrees, which is the trigger now for that. And so people could go there, libraries, places like that.
And I imagine part of securing the home is also replacing, checking and replacing air filters, you know, if people have, you know,
it's a shame that I missed that. You're absolutely right. And we hand filters out to our asthma patients for their HVAC systems. MERV 13 filters. And it's important to use the highest filter your system can stand. You can always look at the manufacturer of your air conditioning unit and look online, and they'll be able to tell you what filter is the most dense it can take. The filters are a little expensive for folks. The MERV 13s tend to run somewhere between $15 and $20 a piece. The good news is you shouldn't have to change them more than every 2 or 3 months. But it's a pretty cheap investment to make. I tell people it's the most effective thing you can do to breathe clean air in your home is to change that filter out for that MERV 13 filter. And they sell them at all the home stores. So,
and for those without central air, is attaching a filter to like a box fan, is that effective?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, using a MERV 13 filter and a 20 by 20 box fan, we've been measuring the velocity of air and the amount of air moving through these fans. And we were able to show that in the average box fan you would buy from Costco or Home Depot, we ordered fans from different manufacturers and did this test using what's called an anemometer. And we were able to show that in the average 1,000-square-foot home, you could clean all the air through a fan in about 15 to 20 minutes. And you'll be able to look at it, so you'll know when it's getting dirty. And that will also tell you, wow, that was in my air, because you will see that dirt accumulate on the back of that filter. I highly recommend them for everybody, actually.
Well, fantastic. Well, Kevin Hamilton, Executive Director of the Central California Asthma Collaborative, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Carrie.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You could hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We've got an app. It's called KVPR. The show is produced by our news team, including Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, Madi Bolaños, and Sarith Hawk. I'm your host, Kathleen Schock. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2022 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvineawards.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, ensuring the voices of Californians are heard in California's decisions about healthcare. On the web at chcf.org/voices.